This is Henrik here. I hope you're doing all right. So if you check the websites, redice.tv and redicemembers.com, you probably saw that our North American Red Ice headquarters on the East Coast actually was in the direct path of Hurricane Matthew, and we were actually urged to evacuate. So we had some of the most important things from the studio packed up and ready to go, but we decided to ride out the storm. It came more or less right over us, and thankfully there was no damage, and we didn't have any major flooding either. It was basically, what's the term, diminished to a Category 2 by the point it came over us, though. So it wasn't, you know, too bad. We had a smaller tree fall right on the roof of the floor just above the studio, but it could have been much, much worse. Now, the only thing, though, is that we are in a zone that is experiencing power outage, so we won't be able to resume regular operations until this is taken care of. There are millions of people, we hear, along the southeast coast that are out of power. So today we have an hour show for you with suspended Twitter legend Ricky Vaughn, a show that is guest hosted by our very own Reinhard Wolf. Thanks to both of you guys for helping us to continue and produce some shows here in this unique circumstance, in this unique situation. We'll keep you updated, check the websites and also our Facebook and Twitter, and we'll let you know when the next radio program and live TV show is coming up. A big thanks to our listeners and especially our subscribers who are sticking with us as we ride this out and clean up after Mother Nature has done her thing. I hope the power won't be gone for too long so that we can get back on track. All right, thanks folks. Stay safe. Here's Reinhard and Ricky Vaughn.
Hello everyone. I'm Reinhard Wolf. As some of you may already know, Hurricane Matthew has forced Henrik and Lana to evacuate from Red Ice headquarters on the East Coast. In light of this, Henrik asked me to guest host this show, and I was more than happy to accept. Our guest today is Ricky Vaughn. Known for his prolific Twitter account, Ricky managed to accumulate over 60,000 followers by tweeting about Trump, cultural Marxism, Jewish influence, racial issues, and much more. In fact, Ricky's Twitter activism landed him at number 107 in MIT's list of the top 150 2016 election influencers. As of earlier this week, however, Ricky was banned from Twitter. So without further ado, let's jump right in. All right, Ricky, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Well, we have a lot to cover today, so let's go ahead and get started. So you were recently banned from Twitter. Why don't you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was just sort of out of the blue. I was suspended. My account was suspended. And I wasn't really contacted by Twitter. We sort of assume that it's a permanent ban, although I filed an appeal, but I don't expect it to go anywhere. We'll see. I haven't heard back from them yet, so.
Yeah, I hope that works out, but, at the same time, you were definitely a very prolific figure on Twitter, so they probably put a great deal of thought into your ban. Do you know if there is anything in particular that got you banned? I know, for example, Milo was banned over making fun of Leslie Jones.
Right, yeah. And I'm not totally sure, but I did have a comment about Ezra Klein where I tagged him in the comment, which is not, it's not against Twitter rules or anything. But, well, right. Their rules are very arbitrary, so really anything could be considered against Twitter rules, so. They were, planning on doing it. They just needed a pretext.
Right.
No matter how weak.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct. They were probably, getting tired with you, supporting Trump and, saying politically incorrect things on there, so.
Yeah.
It was bound to happen at some point.
Right, it was totally bound to happen.
Yeah. So how did you get to the point where you have 60,000 followers on Twitter and MIT is noticing your Twitter account saying that you're one of, you're a very influential person, not only on Twitter, just in general, in the 2016 election? So I guess to kind of answer that question, you'd probably need to go into your Red Pill experience.
Right. So, my Red Pill experience isn't anything special. It's just sort of like gradual over time. Where I was questioning different things going back to 2008. I was disillusioned with the Bush presidency, but I kind of didn't. I checked out liberalism. Kind of got over it by the time I was 18.
Nice.
and checked out conservatism with McCain, but I was drawn more to libertarianism with Ron Paul in 2008 and 2012. But then I got sort of disillusioned with libertarianism and the whole sort of the ideological rigidity of it, the impracticality of it, the way it doesn't seem to align with human nature. And it's sort of become a utopian, cultish political movement at this point.
Yeah.
So the next step would be I sort of realized feminism was, well, I never was totally into feminism, but sort of reading the intellectual case against it and transitioning forward to when Trayvon Martin was shot by George Zimmerman, and just seeing the narrative that was spawned by the mainstream media there was totally the real, you know, that was the point where you realize they're lying, they're spinning false narratives. So, you know, I sort of investigated this, was linked to MPC.com, my posting career, and that was sort of like a really, that was really where it took off. You know, it's a great, great forum. They have all kinds of threads on every subject under the sun, coming at it from a really like hard right wing or conservative angle.
Yeah.
And then jumped on Twitter in 2014, didn't really post much of anything until sort of Gamergate happened, and I was following these trolls, people who are trolls, and seeing, like, just learning from them, seeing what they did. And so I started jumping in a little bit in Gamergate, and then really jumped in it for good in 2015, and we had a small group of people who were coordinating this kind of stuff and learning from each other and laughing a lot, you know.
Of course.
And it just took off with the whole conservative tweeting, Twitter hashtag, National Review Revolt, NRO Revolt hashtag, and a lot of people were drawn to these ideas due to the administration forcing things like gay marriage and tranny bathrooms down everyone's throat. So it just grew from there, and sort of this was the brush that was sparked by the Trump movement. And that's where my count took off, went from 1,000 to 3,000 to 12 to 50, and then ended up at 62 before getting totally banned by Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, I think I followed you around this time last year, and you had, I think it was under 10,000 followers, and
yeah,
I remember going, you know, checking out your profile here and there, and I was just always amazed by how quickly you were growing. And I think a lot of that, I mean, you certainly had really good tweets. They're definitely hilarious, very informative, definitely pointing out a lot of, you know, double standards and, liberal bias and whatnot. But I think you occupied a really interesting kind of, metapolitical position. You were somewhat between the alt-right and kind of mainstream Trump supporters. And I'm willing to bet that a significant amount of that 60,000 was in fact, fairly mainstream Trump supporters. But nevertheless, you talked about some serious stuff. You talked about Jewish influence. You talked about, talking about race and crime, race and IQ on occasion. And, so I think that's why I really appreciated your account so much is, I think you probably red-pilled a lot of these people that were following you. They probably saw that you were, oh, this guy's a, you know, he's a mainstream, or, you know, he's a very well-known Trump Twitter account. He makes fun of liberals. He makes fun of conservatives. Then they follow you, and then they, you know, next thing they know, they're looking into, you know, they're seeing you tweet about Jewish influence, and they're maybe looking up Dr. Kevin McDonald. So I know it's kind of hard to tell from, you know, from your perspective, but I think if we really knew the effect that you had on red-pilling people, I think we'd see that it was very, very substantial.
Oh yeah, and I see that all the time. People telling me, people contacting me saying, "Oh, you know, you were my favorite account. You were what woke me up on all these issues." And you know, I think it's important not to be extremely esoteric all the time.
Right.
And my whole thing was like, I didn't want to try and prove how smart I was or prove how in I was. I just sort of learned, you know, you get inside people's head, learn how people think, and communicate to them at their level in language and aesthetics and imagery that they understand. And that's the best way to make, to take a message to a mass audience, which was sort of what I was trying to do and had a great deal of success doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely seemed to work out. So I'm curious, were there any Twitter experiences in particular that kind of stick out to you? I think my favorite experience on Twitter, at least one of them, was watching Cher's meltdown over, you know, the Nazi cartoon frogs. Do you have any that kind of come to mind?
Oh, yeah, that was great. That was great. well, this is kind of an obscure one, but it sticks out in my mind. I don't know if you've ever been on NPC, but they have this guy called That One Guy. And That One Guy is like a great poster, and he's always coming from things at a very conspiratorial angle, but he makes it work. He doesn't just sound like a raving guy. And he trolled Seth Rogen with this chart or something. You know, he trolled Seth Rogen about Jewish influence in media or something and the ownership, and he posted this image, and I think it was this chart of all of the owners of various media and the high-ranking executives and what their ethnic background was. And Seth Rogen replied to it or retweeted it or something, and it ended up with 400,000 impressions, which is a lot. Like, even my biggest tweets would only get like 200,000. So I just thought it was hilarious that 400,000 were exposed to this image of showing, you know, how many of the owners and top executives of all of the, you know, there's only six of them now, major media corporations, were Jewish or married to a Jew, and it was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It's, you know, Seth Rogen's retweeting it, obviously, to kind of draw attention to, you know, how crazy these people in the alt-right are. Like, everyone needs to see this, but I'm sure more than one person, you know, actually evaluated the graph and, that everything contained therein was in fact true. So those things have a way of backfiring sometimes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it is drip, like the drip effect. People won't believe something the first time, but if, you know, they might look at it and say, this is crazy, but the second, third, or tenth time, they might take a look at it, and or recent events might start making them curious about things. And then they take a look at it and they're convinced. So just getting these messages out for a mass audience is extremely useful.
Yeah, it certainly is. So you're on Facebook now, correct? Are you planning to have that kind of be your are you planning to set up shop there, so to speak?
I'm kind of setting up shop there for now. Some people are trying to help me gain followers, which is great. But I really want to launch a website, so that's going to be in the works.
Nice.
Getting banned from Twitter was almost like a blessing. I could move more into long form because Twitter is so addicting and it's all short form and it's like really quick blasts of information, but I can move more into like medium or long form.
Yeah.
With a website, and hopefully that'll be something that's good.
Yeah, definitely. You've already built a brand and a name for yourself, so I think the hard work is done at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I wanted to talk about this. The day after you were banned, Google and Disney pulled out of Twitter, and their stock dropped by 17%. I think that's probably more of a coincidence than anything, but I mean, I'm sure that probably makes you feel... That was probably nice to wake up to the next day, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was totally hilarious. And although I think it's 100% just a coincidence,
right?
You know, it just goes to show you could say God or you could say the universe is looking out for us right now, or Keck.
Yeah, I was about to say, many might say Keck is looking out for us. But, yeah, anyways. So speaking of Twitter, I don't know too much about the company's financial situation, but I've been told that they're not very successful. I remember Chuck Johnson, in fact, saying that Twitter has never been particularly profitable. Where do you see do you know if that's true, and where do you see the future of Twitter going?
Right. Well, it's true. It's pretty true. I don't know if they make money or lose money, but I can tell you that they don't make a whole lot of money. And they've just been sort of a beneficiary of the tech bubble, whereas all this Federal Reserve money and credit, cheap credit, sort of has flooded into the internet and these new media spheres. So their stock has crashed, a lot. I don't know the exact details of how much it's crashed, but they're not really making money. They're not really growing their user base because it's not like Facebook where everyone's on it. There's only like 2 or 3% of the people in the country are on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have trouble monetizing it with ads. So Twitter, I don't know, maybe they should have stayed a private company. They're having problems. It would be nice to have a Twitter service that was sort of neutral on these free speech issues. It would be nice if it was like almost like a public utility. But I'm not, too hopeful about that. Like we had the phone system became a public utility.
Right.
But because I don't know if it's really going to ever make money for these people who are running it. What they maybe should do is monetize for the power users. So make the companies pay for their account, like make influential people who are obviously seeing value from having a Twitter account, whether you're a major media company or something, and make them pay for it. And then, so you get the people who are willing to pay for it, pay for it.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting possibility. I know that, I don't care about Jack and the Twitter team and Twitter itself too much, but kind of from a selfish perspective, I hope that Twitter is able to stay around for a while just because of how useful it is to the alt-right. People talk about it would be nice for there to be kind of an alt-right version of Twitter or an alt-right version of Facebook where we wouldn't have to face censorship and we wouldn't have
right.
to get shut down and whatnot. But the common rebuttal to that is that the main benefit of these big social media platforms is the fact that they allow us to interact with normies and to red pill people. And obviously we wouldn't be able to enjoy that benefit on a platform of our own. And in fact, I think that from my experience with alt-right forums and whatnot, when it's kind of a contained space and everyone's alt-right, that leads to a lot of counterproductive purity spiraling and factionalism within the movement. So maybe it's a good thing that
right.
that we don't have our own media platforms yet, or social media rather.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important to have both. Well, we do have a new platform called Gab.
Yeah.
Which is growing, and they're building out new features. I don't know if they're gonna when they're going to like right now. You have to be logged in to see the content. So I assume that eventually they're going to go public with it. It's important to have these platforms that are purely dedicated to free speech and that can compete with Twitter. But yeah, we still need to be on the major platforms saying what we can get away with saying without getting banned in order to get the message out and argue with people who disagree with us and troll people who are, terrible people. And yeah, I'll also obviously convert people to the cause, which has been huge for which was what I was doing a lot of, was converting people who were Tea Party conservatives or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think Gab is really interesting because at this point, there are a lot of people, a lot of mainstream Trump supporters that dislike censorship. They're the kind of people that would follow you, but, not necessarily. They might, at this point, kind of feel more at home with Milo or Gavin McInnes and those types.
Right.
But I think something like Gab is going to attract a lot of those people, and they're definitely ripe for, being red-pilled. So while having a free speech platform, social media platform, could be beneficial so long as it's, you know, what some people call the alt-light and the alt-right, because then right. it would just be us and our, essentially our target demographic. We wouldn't be able to harass Rick Wilson or any of our other favorite characters, but nevertheless, I think it'd be good for red pilling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So have you had any, during your time on Twitter, did you ever have any prolonged conversations with any of these mainstream conservative pundits, such as, you know, Rick Wilson and what's the other guy's name? Nick Searcy, is that it?
Oh, yeah, right. mm-hmm. In terms of conversation, not really. It was just sort of like taking shots at each other.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You know, back and forth. Never really converse with many of these people. You know, they're just not willing to. I mean, they've got this image in their mind that they want to have of a, you know, Nazi, neo-Nazi, blah, 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 white supremacist people. And, you know, the whole idea is you don't talk to these people. You don't give their platform them. You don't give them a space. So that's why we troll them, right? Because
if
they're not going to converse with us or have a debate with us, we just sort of have to like mercilessly ridicule them and point out the flaws in their logic and have success. We had a lot of success with doing it too, showing people how ridiculous these conservative figures were.
Yeah, and you can tell that it gets to them. Like for Rick Wilson, for example, I think his location on Twitter, on his profile, I know it was this for a while, maybe it changed, but it said inside Trump's head. And then I remember looking at his Twitter timeline, and all of his tweets were kind of, you know, petulant responses to alt-right tweets, or it was all making fun of Trump. And I'm sure Trump knows who Rick Wilson is, but I mean, the irony there, the complete opposite is true. Like we and, you know, Trump, of course, because the alt-right is certainly related to the Trump phenomenon. We have been given free space inside their head, their heads rather. We've been able to get under their skin, and that's, I think there's something unique to Twitter that allows you to do that. Just the fact that it's so easy to interact with, you know, with just about anyone on Twitter. Like, sure, they can mute you and block you, but they have to do that afterwards. The same isn't the case on Facebook.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, these people really do get rattled. And it's funny because a lot of them, you can tell, one of the big reasons for not supporting Trump is they're convinced that there is this, you know, hordes of terrible racist people holding up pitchforks coming for them.
Right.
And it's all because, you know, people have made fun of them on Twitter repeatedly. And then you have other people doing more extreme, like, photoshopping stuff, like the Stormer Army, which is pretty, like, you know, I don't get into any of the illegal stuff, like death threats or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, so they're doing the extreme stuff, and it's like, you know, you have to have a thick skin on Twitter. You have to be able to ignore or block these people, and some of them seem to be incapable of doing it, and they start panicking and complaining to Twitter headquarters that, you know, there was a mean picture of them on Twitter. So it's a pretty funny thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole alt-right phenomenon is probably very horrifying for a lot of people, both mainstream conservatives, cuck-servatives, and mainstream liberals, in general, honestly. I think that, you know, just over the course of the Obama campaign, they were kind of convinced that the battle against racism, which they see as being some kind of, like, cosmic struggle with like, some, you know, like, the universal good is on their side. And they thought that they won, and they thought that this was something, and especially, you see this a lot in millennials, because they've been raised in this. They've been molded by it, even. They that's all that they know. They thought, they see racism as just being something relegated to, I don't know, you know, people in trailer parks and all that. But seeing the resurgence of it and seeing the fact that it's, Twitter tolerates quite a fair amount of it, to be frank. You see the breakdowns, you see Twitter or Share, you know, on Twitter. That was a perfect example. Leslie Jones, another example. And, right. Yeah, I just think it's interesting that these people, they just weren't prepared for this to happen, essentially.
No, they really weren't prepared, and a lot of them are sitting in their cosmopolitan bubbles, and they're interacting with, you know, basically other cosmopolitan people, and they just don't get it. They really don't get that.
They don't.
You just can't have diversity sort of within the amongst the common people. It just doesn't work that way. Like, when you take all of the smartest people around the world and put them all at Harvard, then you can have some kind of, like, you can have some kind of diversity. Even then, you have self-segregation into groups, into frats and that sort of thing, African frat, whatever frat. Even then, you have this sort of self, but they're living in this, in a bubble world where, you know, they think that they're going to be able to create this cosmopolitan version of conservatism, but it's just not going to happen because there's just no record of, you know, so many diverse peoples being able to cohabit in peace and tranquility. It just doesn't happen. There's got to be one group has to be in power. There's no such thing. I don't think there's a such thing as a sharing power, like a power sharing situation.
Oh, of course not.
So you're going to have chaos, and you're going to have nationalist movements. You're going to have nationalist movements with tribal movements, political movements. Politics is going to be tribal. So if you look at their whole, you've heard of the autopsy from 2012, where the GOP decided we have to reach out to all these groups. And I agree they should reach out to these groups in the sense of, you know, reaching out to working class people saying, basically, we are the strong horse. We are, you know, we're going to have a strong America First nationalist policy and break off the chunks of the other groups. But to think that they're going to go out and convince these people to believe in free trade absolutism, you know, lowering the corporate gain tax and all, what else, you know, all of their little pet issues, all the while completely ignoring issues like immigration, foreign policy, national issues, which are much more important for a national government to be looking at anyways. So they were really living in a fantasy land, and I'm not surprised that these very stupid and people who have become very effete and isolated and weak were so taken aback and wiped out by the Trump campaign.
Yeah, it's definitely been a very, very rewarding experience. Prior to Trump coming along, I was somewhat red-pilled. It didn't kind of completely come together until about last October, but I knew at that point that I hated mainstream conservatism, the mainstream right, and liberalism. So, you know, and I'm certainly not alone. I mean, obviously, that's why Trump is so popular. He's coming along talking about things that, you know, everyone has been thinking, everyone has been, you know, maybe some people have been talking about, but frankly, a lot of people are afraid to talk about these ideas just because they're so taboo. But he truly does represent the, you know, the silent majority, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he's speaking in working class language, speaking to working class people, and using the sort of unabashed patriotism that we haven't seen. You know, Romney definitely wasn't able to tap into that. We haven't seen a candidate run on this sort of platform as George Bush.
Yeah, it's definitely very refreshing, and it's a very healthy kind of patriotism. It isn't jingoism. It isn't, you know, we need to go spread democracy. Obviously, it's untainted by neoconservatism. It's
right.
It's, you know, the radical and apparently really controversial idea that a nation's government should do what's in the best interest of the nation's people and the nation overall. I mean, the fact that we're at the point where that is, you know, you start talking about that and, you know, people respond by bringing up the Holocaust, that really just shows how degenerate things have become.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, you're right about what you say. It was a very genuine thing. It's a genuine feeling. And isn't it funny how hollow and jingoistic it sounds when it's a bunch of neocons trying to manipulate public opinion to go bomb Syria or bomb Iraq or whatever, go blow up Iran or start a shooting war with Russia over Syria.
Right.
You know, that's not genuine patriotism. You can just tell these people are totally cynical about what they're saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's absolutely disgusting to me.
It is, and it's time for them to pack up and leave. Yeah, so Ricky, I wanted to ask you where you think we're headed in terms of free speech. As you already know, I'm sure, many European countries already have very Orwellian hate speech laws.
Right.
Countries such as Sweden, Germany, and the UK, if you say the wrong thing on the internet, you could have to, and I'm not talking about, you know, inciting violence, I'm talking about, you know, expressing disdain over immigration policies, for example. So, you know, if you do something like that in these countries, you can, you know, face legal repercussions. So could you see that happening here? I mean, obviously a lot of that is going to be contingent on who wins in November. So why don't you talk about that for a little bit?
Right, I see. Yeah, I think it definitely could happen here. I don't know if they will be able to marshal the public opinion in favor of it at this point in terms of hate speech laws, because we have the First Amendment tradition. But you know, as the sort of Anglo, it's sort of like free speech is totally an Anglo thing. It's in a lot of respects, it's not even so much an Germanic thing or, you know, Northern Nordic thing.
Yeah.
It really is almost like an Anglo thing. And we have less Anglos in this country. Eventually, you have less demand for things like free speech. People don't really care. They're going to take free speech absolutism. They're not going to care about it. And it would be tough, I think. But you never know. Like, if you have Hillary Clinton working with Congress, you know, with a lot of conservatives in it, maybe they could get those votes to pass some legislation. And I can actually imagine it would actually probably be a priority for them. They've been laying the rhetorical groundwork for this, you know, basically an attack on American heritage for a long time, obviously in the universities, attacking, you know, the Confederate flag,
right,
saying that the Confederate statues should come down. And then once they take the Confederate statues down, the next thing will be the Founding Fathers should come down. You know, the Washington Monument should come down because Washington was a slave owner or whatever. So they've been laying the rhetorical groundwork. They've been laying the groundwork in the universities. The next generation might just be too apathetic and might just let it happen.
Yeah.
And then there are other things, like, obviously, besides hate speech laws, there's a number of things they could do in terms of, obviously, digital platform censorship, where we are, you know, you already know you can't say much on Facebook without getting 30 days suspended or banned or whatever.
Yeah, what do they call it? Getting zucked?
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, in Germany where they've Facebook has removed millions and millions of posts.
Yep.
They could do that here to a greater extent than they already are doing it. And, then you have Twitter, obviously more of a free speech zone, but, the problem is that other sites, if these sites become too heavy handed, then you're going to have the rise of other sites like Gab, or forums where people can speak their mind. So then, you know, what the next step they could do is, with the whole internet handover to the UN, where they're going to start messing with, DNS, registration or whatever. Like people actually owning their own websites, starting to have problems or even get shut down. And then the other thing they could do is try and get rid of anonymity. Having almost like a code, like a, you know, a login code or something, like almost like a driver's license to use the internet. Yeah, so they could do all this stuff. We'll see. It's going to be a battle. It's going to be a fight. You think right now that the tide is turning towards sort of away from globalism and towards nationalist movements. But it's hard to say for sure. Like, you know, they can have the globalists obviously you can, maybe technology is going to help them fulfill their aims. And it's hard to say what's going to happen with politically. Really hard to say what's going to happen.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as the kind of the fires of nationalism continue to spread and rise, I think there's definitely going to be a pushback from the globalists. So, you know, as the Trump phenomenon continues, and, you know, whether or not he wins, the kind of the cat has been let out of the bag, so to speak, and there's going to be, there's going to be kind of pushback from the globalists. They're not just going to sit back and kind of allow this to spread. I think they're going to try to do what they can to contain it. For right now, I think Hillary Clinton wants the alt-right to spread and grow and kind of rise to the surface. I think that's why she brought up the alt-right. I doubt she really understands it, but given by her bringing up Alex Jones, of all people, you know, a guy who spent, you know, decades ranting about, you know, the Jesuit, Nazi, white supremacist, you know, whatever, is definitely not the Jews, right? But, anyways, it's, so she doesn't really understand it, but she sees that it's something racist, right? Quote unquote racist, and something that can be tied to Trump. So I think for the time being, they're gonna, well, not to imply that Hillary has, you know, has control over everything, but I think a lot of the left wants the alt-right to continue. The more intelligent leftists, I would say, understand that if the alt-right grows, they can keep attempting to tie it to Trump. I don't think it's been successful thus far. He's had a really masterful response. He was just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Just kind of makes her look like kind of kooky, you know, calling out this obscure internet movement and based around a cartoon frog.
Right, absolutely. But they are taking, it's true from the perspective of Hillary Clinton's campaign, but they are taking it very seriously, I think, and they're trying to marginalize it. How successful are they going to actually be? Can they marginalize it in the eye of the public using their media platforms? Is much harder for them to do because, you know, no one pays attention to CNN or anything like that anymore. But they can sort of mold public opinion on Facebook, but even that's kind of difficult to do because it's a decentralized platform. So, for example, they've been able to basically ruin Trump's reputation on Facebook, but they haven't been able to boost Hillary Clinton's reputation on Facebook. She's still deeply hated by millennials. they can sort of use it to ruin someone's reputation. They can't really build up their own reputation. And if it fails, if their attempts to marginalize it fail, who knows what they could actually do? Who knows what they would actually try at that point? I don't think they would just give up, you know.
Certainly not. So, yeah, I wanted to ask you regarding the current election. Do you think there's going to be an October surprise for, you know, coming from either side of this spectrum, whether it's, you know, Julian Assange releasing something particularly damaging to Hillary Clinton, or, you know, some people have kind of speculated that Hillary could maybe do something. And then granted, that's kind of getting into the realm of, speculation, theorizing about, you know, potential, you know.
Well, we know
far out there stuff, but go on.
Right. Well, we already know what's happening is Hillary Clinton is dripping out her opposition research very slowly. You know, every couple of days they drop a story. Like when you see something by Kurt Eichenwald, just know that he didn't, you know, do any of that research. It was Hillary Clinton campaign given the research. And then he writes a story on it. So they're dripping out their opposition research to their, you know, reporters, to their outlets. So every 3 days you'd have something like Trump did something wrong. Trump called, they had something like a reporter came out and said, Trump called me a cunt in the 1980s. Like, okay, even if you believe that, it was like ridiculous.
Right.
So they have all these little stories that are going to just keep coming out. It's hard for that to rise above the noise, though, and become a story other than it can rally their own troops. But So I don't know about an actual major October surprise from the Hillary Clinton camp. They're probably saving some of their juicier stuff for last. Will it be effective? Hopefully not. And then the Trump camp, I don't know. Like, I feel like Trump can go extremely negative on Hillary if he wants to in the last few weeks just by hammering on her health issues and sort of hammering her on other things. Like, we'll see. I don't know if he's actually going to try and make the Bill Clinton story stick. The whole Hillary Clinton enabling and sort of going after the women that Bill Clinton either had as mistresses or actually raped. And then obviously, so I don't know about that. And then there's the wild card, Julian Assange, claiming that he's going to be releasing weekly information on Hillary Clinton until the election. So we have 4 weeks, so he could do 3 or 4 releases. And who knows if he's got anything that's going to actually be big. So I wouldn't count on it. I think the debates are going to be the two biggest things. We'll see if there's an actual October surprise.
Yeah, I think it's kind of disappointing, but I think that the people that are already convinced that Hillary Clinton should be leading the country, I think they're so beyond saving. They're voting for purely emotional reasons or purely ideological reasons, which is, I mean, that part's understandable.
Right.
But, I mean, I think the kind of disappointing or even depressing aspect to this is if Julian Assange released something particularly damning of Hillary Clinton, I don't think that would have any effect. I really don't. I think Hillary Clinton supporters would continue supporting her. I mean, it's right. Kind of hard to imagine something that could be released that would cause her to lose a substantial amount of support.
Yeah, absolutely. And it would have to be really big, and it would have to be simple enough to sort of capture the public's imagination.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Specky, we were talking about, you know, what the best case release could be. The leak could be the other night when Julian Assange was, you know, everyone thought he was going to release something particularly damning to Hillary Clinton. But I think if something came out saying that Hillary had used the N-word or said something very racist at some point, I think that could do it. I mean, corruption, all of that, everyone's just going to write it off as, you know, conservative propaganda and so forth. But
right.
if Hillary Clinton, it was revealed she sinned against, you know, the cult of, you know, equality and multiculturalism and multiracialism, I think that could be something that would stick to it. Because at the end of the day, she is white, right? You know, the woman
right.
gets you so far.
Exactly. But, exactly. The question is, can she turn out these people that don't like her? You know,
yeah.
Whether it's minorities or millennials.
Yeah, definitely. You know, going back to the free speech thing, one thing that we have to keep in mind is the changing demographics, obviously. Even if in Hillary's, let's hope that Hillary doesn't get elected, but say she does and say she tries passing some, you know, some hate speech legislation, starts restricting free speech, I think she would have to do it. In order to be successful, she would probably have to do it slowly, in increments. But we have to consider the ongoing demographic transformation in America. There have been a number of Pew Research polls that have shown that millennials and frankly, non-whites, Hispanics in particular, don't value free speech. Then they don't particularly value the First Amendment. And I think there are a lot of reasons to that. I think, like you said, you were talking about the Anglo aspect to all of this, but
right.
You know, people coming from countries that don't have a history of free speech, they don't particularly care about it, understand it, or value it. And I think part of all of that too, and this is part of why millennials and especially liberals don't care about free speech, is because they have the high ground at this point. They know that free speech only, if you're in power, you don't you don't really benefit from free speech. It's because free speech allows you to be criticized, right? It allows your ideas
Absolutely.
To be subject to intense criticism. And the left, back during the 60s, you know, they rallied around free speech as if it's, this great liberal, Marxist leftist value. And, now that they're in, we see what happens on college campuses. We see what happens in the media. They used free speech to get into power, and then they essentially turned around and are working to undo and remove that legal protection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you can see they're definitely doing that, especially groups like the ADL and stuff.
You know,
the ADL just sent lawyers, or maybe one lawyer, or maybe multiple lawyers, to Silicon Valley, full-time, to start badgering the social media companies. And the ACLU was at the forefront of free speech for a while. And, you don't hear a lot about the ACLU lately, do you? It's all about the ADL and the...
Very true.
What's the other one? SPLC, right?
Right.
You don't hear about the ACLU too often. I remember they actually insisted upon free speech. They insisted upon a Nazi march in, small-town Illinois, which is almost like kind of silly. But this was the kind of thing they were advocating for back decades ago.
Right. Yeah, these are... Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so you don't hear about them too much. You hear about, basically mostly Jews whining about free speech on Twitter and this and that.
Right.
Hate speech is rising, and they start calling it terrorism. They start calling, flyers being posted terrorism and stuff like that. It was just ridiculous. And you do sort of see a sort of party breakdown where some of the more red states are still saying, okay, we don't agree, but it's free speech. Whereas some of the more blue states and the blue state campuses are freaking out, like University of Michigan.
Yeah.
Freaking out over, stuff on campus that is supposedly making the diversity uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, regarding free speech, one thing I wanted to touch on was, the fact that on the overreaction that I've been seeing on college campuses for quite some time regarding things that are, heretical within, the current year, the cult of equality. I saw a recent headline that there was a number of students at a university, I forget the particular university. Oh, you know what? It was Harvard. A number of students at Harvard, and I believe some officials as well, received an email urging people to vote Trump to combat white genocide, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And people were horrified. And to me, that's...
Oh, yeah, at Harvard, yeah.
Yeah, to me, that's... I mean, I understand people being non-white and not caring about white genocide, right? I think that's probably somewhat normal. History is the competition of groups, between groups for, power and resources, pretending... we're not conservatives. We don't, pretend that these group dynamics don't exist. It's politics is war by other means. I think if a lot of these people, a lot of non-white interest groups had their way, we would be in far worse position than we are now. But what I wanted to draw attention to was the fact that, this triggered a police investigation. I mean, whether or not anything will come of that is different, but, it's just, it's really insane. And something a few weeks ago, I think it was either UC Davis or UC Santa Cruz. There's an individual who was photographed leaving packages around a campus, and within the email referred to them as bias-motivated materials. I've been seeing them use that phrase more recently, bias-motivated stuff, which is...
Oh, yeah, bias-motivated crime. And
Yeah.
Silly.
And once you read the posting and you see what he was actually putting, and it was essentially... It was CDs that had information on, alt-right issues. It wasn't inciting violence. It wasn't calling for genocide or anything, extreme. It was just pretty much, spreading, you know, bad information. Well, not bad information, you know, politically correct information. And interestingly, in that particular instance, the guy was wearing the pictures are pretty funny. The guy's wearing a Red Eye shirt, kind of an unbuttoned button-up shirt, and then he's wearing like these flame sunglasses.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. That guy's a hero as far as I'm concerned. But
yeah, it really is amazing what they're doing. It actually gives us a huge opening, right?
Yeah,
because there's a huge opening there, I think, on college campuses. I think we need, like, now that I'm banned from Twitter, we can move to other things, like, you know, thinking of ideas to propagate these, you know, thinking of ways to propagate these ideas. And I see a huge opportunity for appealing to these sort of disillusioned people on college campuses. And we could do it in almost like a politically neutral way, like, you know, people don't want to be openly hating on other people or...
Right.
Being accused of racism, where you can put it into terms like, you know, all these groups have, you know, their advocacy groups. We need our, you know, we need to stick together. You don't need to say we need to, you don't need to go form something like a white association for the advancement of white people or anything corny like that. I think you just have to raise group consciousness. To begin with, by saying things like, you know, hear all this crap about you're racist, you're sexist, you're homophobic, you're patriarchal, you're privileged. You know, white people need to sort of stick together and basically, you know, come together as groups, stop thinking of yourself so much as a rootless individual. And if we can just put this sort of message out to these college campuses, and then maybe, you know, start getting kids more interested in socializing with people that are like them. You know, like it always is. Like it always used to be.
Yeah.
Until white people became very, you know, willing to do this experiment, this diversity experiment. And, you know, you can almost put in those terms. It's been a 50-year experiment. You know, it's totally failed or it's on its way to failing. Unless you want to just be a scapegoat the rest of your life as a white male, right?
Yeah.
You can say it's failed unless you want to be sort of a scapegoat and, you know, self-flagellating, masochistic, cuckold the rest of your life. So right. I think there's a huge opening for something like this to raise group consciousness. It's going to happen whether we do anything or not. It's just going to happen organically.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a member of Identity Europa, and I've... Recently, we started a project we called Project Siege, in which we hit college campuses across the country with flyers. We did a big social media campaign showing where we've been, showing, you know, pictures of the flyers on campus. And we've actually we've started engaging with students on campus. And granted, we're profiling, you know, white guys who don't look like betas. We're not going up to talk to white guys with, you know, blue hair and Hillary shirts, but we've had the reception and the interactions that we've had, that I've had personally have been pretty, people have been very receptive. They're very positive. You start talking about, you know, kind of the anti-white bias. You start talking about, you know, all of this stuff that's happening, Black Lives Matter, and they get it. They really do. In fact, I had one student who, with whom I was speaking, and, you know, I kind of started off talking about Trump's wall and, you know, asking him how he felt about the fact that Mexico can have a wall to keep out, you know, maybe some more indigenous people from, you know, Guatemala and elsewhere. And the fact that we've paid right. for it, we've helped fund them, but, you know, building a wall between us and Mexico is, you know, essentially another Holocaust, depending on who you talk
exactly.
to. And so we started talking about that, and then I introduced myself. I gave him an Identity Europa flyer, told him who I was with. And then I started going back into and like, how do you feel about, and then he stopped me. He was like, dude, I get it. Like, trust me, I think about this stuff all the time. And, you know, we've had people apply saying, you know, thank you for letting me know I'm not alone in this liberal hell.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, if you think about it, there are, you know, it's hard to tell how many people have been red-pilled, but at least tens of thousands, in America, you know, through 4chan, through Red Ice, through, all of these other websites. But you've got to keep in mind that a lot of a lot of people don't spend that much time on the internet, or if they do, they're on Facebook or something for an hour a day, and that's, I mean, honestly, that's not a bad thing. It's better than, you know, playing video games for 10 hours a day and browsing Reddit, but, you know, we have to start spreading our message, like you said, out in person. As Nathan likes to say, when you occupy a space, you occupy minds. So thus far, we've been occupying a lot of space, you know, digital space, you know, online, Twitter, Facebook, comment sections, elsewhere. So now it's time for us to really take this to, you know, out into meat space, so to speak. And
yeah, absolutely.
We've just kind of started doing that with Identity Europa, but it's been very successful so far.
Right. That's great to hear. Yeah, it's great to hear, and I agree. And a lot of it is dropping the esoteric, you know, all the esoteric stuff. And
right.
Being able to communicate is so important to everyone, you know, on a universal level. A lot of that was what I was doing on my Twitter account. You know, I would obviously have tweets that were more like, you know, in-group tweets. But a lot of it, what I was doing, is messaging and news that anyone could relate to. And, so that's one of the difficult things, moving from internet to real life for some people. You know, as in any internet movement, you've got people who are, you know, poorly socialized.
Right.
Or whatever. So, yeah, it is sort of like, if you keep pushing these things and recruiting more people who are, and sort of, I think you want to have sources that are like hardcore on the ideology or whatever, but when you're out, you know, doing more like mass political movements, you could sort of tone down the ideology or drop it altogether.
Yeah.
And just stick to sort of things that people can relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's probably best to, you know, maybe talk about, you know, the anti-white sentiments in the media and academia, like the double standards, stuff like that, rather than jumping into, you know, talking about how Hitler was the, you know, 10th incarnation of Vishnu or something. That you can save that stuff for later.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ricky, I've enjoyed speaking with you. I think we definitely covered some really interesting stuff today. So you're on Facebook, correct?
That's right, Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Facebook. And people can find you just by searching for Ricky Vaughn, I'm assuming.
It's like under the name facebook.com/deplorablevaughn.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
on my page.
And you said that you're going to be creating a website at some point. Do you have any idea when that's
Website dropping within like 2 weeks.
Within 2 weeks. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I would say. Mm-hmm.
So everyone should definitely be on the lookout for that. And are you on Gab right now? Or are you considering?
I'm on Gab right now.
Okay.
I'm on Gab right now. It's growing, which is nice. Yeah, I have 3,500 followers or something.
Okay.
I had like 1,400 before I got banned, so it's growing. They're accepting new users every day, and they're rolling out new features. So hopefully it becomes you know, just as good as Twitter. Eventually, you know, it's gonna be a while till it gets there, I'm sure. And you know, you never know what happens. You could get, if it becomes an attractive forum for young people, you know, it could supplant some of these other social media. You know, it could supplant Twitter. I'm not, you know, say it will or anything, but it could start competing with some of these other social networks over time if things go right.
Yeah, I think it definitely has the potential for that. Well, Ricky, it was nice speaking with you. Everyone should make sure to follow Ricky on Facebook, Twitter, Gab, and then be on the lookout for his website.
Thanks a lot for having me.